The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This episode is sponsored by Smarkets. I'm Joe Twyman, co-founder and director of Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie Leconte.
This week it's a Polling Politics special. We are in Washington and we're in London. I'm in Washington to discuss the midterms and we have Marie in London. Hello, Marie.
Hello. Yeah, no, I'm actually in South London today, so it's a very exciting week for all of us.
Yeah, we're all travelling to new and unusual places. This is very exciting. I should stress, in the interest of accuracy, I am in Washington, but Washington State, not Washington DC. I'm in the lovely city of Seattle to discuss various aspects of the midterm elections with American politicos over here. But before we do that, quick discussion about the UK scene. Good news, Marie. David Cameron is coming back to British politics, or perhaps not.
Yay! I mean, I wish you could see my face right now, just, you know, basically crying with happiness. Just so overjoyed at the fact that David Cameron might be coming back.
What was interesting to me about this story was that it was an exclusive that he'd spoken to friends to say that he was coming back, and followed by another exclusive to say he wasn't. I assume the latter is the case. What's your take on this?
I know, but also, actually, you know, in fairness, like, in all seriousness, I did find it quite interesting because the original sort of like Sun scoop was David Cameron told friends that X, but then the denial came, I think, from Politics Home, and the story was effectively, you know, actually Cameron has told friends that he's not doing it. So that entire story has just been done by the medium of, you know, what his friends are saying, which I still find like it's such a weird aspect of kind of like British political reporting of the, you know, friends of have said that. Well, actually, you know, other friends of have said. It's just a deeply odd way to report the news.
I entirely agree. Well, we will see whether he fires a certain set of friends for briefing against him. But that's if he indeed has any real friends left.
But you know, I guess like the one other thing as well about this is that I loved, you know, and I, you know, obviously have no idea if that's true or not, but I love the idea that he was like, oh, I want to be foreign secretary because I'm bored.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that is the man who, when he was asked, why do you want to be prime minister, said, you know, why did you want to become prime minister, said, you know, because I thought I'd be good at it. And it's just, you know, that kind of level of shamelessness of being like, yes, my entire career has basically just been smugness and like FOMO, I guess.
Yeah, and he'd done so well in dealing with Europe when he was Prime Minister. He'd inevitably do a great job as Foreign Secretary. Certainly the public overwhelmingly see a return to politics with David Cameron as an unpopular thing, and a majority are against it. I can't see public opinion changing very much on that.
Yeah, me neither.
One person who is definitely leaving politics, at least frontbench politics, is Tracy Crouch, who resigned on an issue of principle. Now, this is almost unheard of. I mean, I don't know what she thinks. Is this the 19th century where politicians will resign simply because they fundamentally disagree with the actions of their party? Quite remarkable. Tracy Crouch resigned over fixed odd betting machines and the speed in which rules were being implemented or not. Is this significant story or just a Westminster bubble thing?
I think yes and no. So I would say that the one aspect of it I did find quite interesting and eyebrow raising was the fact that quite prominent Brexiteers, including Boris Johnson and others, kind of tweeted being like, you know, like what a loss for government, etc., etc., which would not have been obvious to me. Like they were not necessarily, you know, like they're not on the same wing as the party as Tracy Crouch. You know, if I remember correctly, is definitely not a kind of, you know, hardcore Brexiteer or anything. So I'm not really sure what was going on there. But the idea that, you know, kind of everyone was like, oh my God, Tracy. I mean, maybe it's just the fact that Tory benches want to get rid of Theresa May. So any bad thing that happened, they're like, yeah, no, just so bad. But yeah, no, beyond that, I think that's kind of, yeah, it was quite straightforward, really, of just, it just felt like such a kind of like self-inflicted wound from Number 10, because Tracy Crouch was really well liked. You know, she is a minister who people respected, and I think cross-party as well. And the Nishi, where she's definitely going to be on the right side of history. So it just struck me as a bit dumb, I think is the professional word for it.
Get ready for this segue. And speaking of people who hope they're on the right side of history, Dominic Raab. he believes that Britain is an island, but he's only just found out. Was this a bit of a revelation for you, Marie?
Oh, man, I am so tired of these stories. Because also, I feel like, you know, I'd like to say that comes on the week where Jeremy Wright, the bloody, you know, Secretary of State for for Culture, Media and Sport was asked what, you know, what papers he reads, and basically didn't say any. Like, he just reads Time magazine, which in a weird way was fascinating because I did not think anyone ever actually read Time magazine. They have nothing against it per se, but also it's just not something it ever occurred to me that people read. So I think, you know, like, we've had that, then we've had the Brexit secretary basically saying, oh, you know, yeah, it turns out we're kind of surrounded by sea. And a few months ago we had Karen Bradley basically going, oh, I'd not realised that people in Northern Ireland voted among sectarian lines. It's, you know, been fascinating looking at that. And it's like, how did Theresa May pick all those people? Like, genuinely, how? Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, the Rob thing, I'm kind of just like, yeah, fine, what next? You know, just, yeah, what next?
Well, you know who we really need? David Cameron.
can we not? No, Matt Hancock. And as on that note, and there's something deeply upsetting I need to say, because I think that, like, I can literally no longer talk about Matt Hancock, because a friend of mine in Westminster a few days ago said that in their office they all call him Mancock as a weird nickname, and genuinely it's just ruined Matt for me entirely, so I might just have to stop talking about him on the podcast.
Oh god, oh dear. Marie, I'm going to ask you the same question I'm asking my guests in America. What percentage of Americans do you think believe in possession by the devil?
Oh, like, probably something, like, weirdly high. Like, I would say 27%.
27? Okay, well, we'll come back and see if you're correct at the end of the show.
Oh, fine.
Great. Thanks, Marie.
Oh, cheers.
Joining us now is Matt Makowiak. Matt is a Republican consultant. He is Potomac Strategy Group president and a Washington Times columnist. Welcome, Matt.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was an absolute pleasure. And now you run your own podcast on American politics,
I do.
Believe. Would
I
you
do.
Like to give that a quick
well,
plug?
Well, of course I would love to. It's called Mac on Politics, M-A-C-K on Politics. We've done 106 episodes.
Wow, 106. Blimey, we've got nowhere near
cabinet
that.
Secretaries and senators and members of Congress and authors and all kinds of people you can find on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and at MacOnPoliticsPodcast.com.
Fantastic. I want to discuss for our British listeners what you, as a Republican, how you view these results. Was it a good day at the office or a bad day at the office for the Republican Party?
Okay, it was a split decision. You know, it's like a boxing match that goes to the end and there's no winner declared. Both sides have something positive they can take from it. Both sides have something negative I think they should be concerned about. Look, it's never a good thing when you lose control of Congress, when you lose control of the House. And you had, I think, 35 or 36 seats flipped. Democrats needed 23, and they got there. That's actually in a historical range that's pretty standard. In your first midterm after a new president's elected, generally the party in the White House loses seats in that range. So it's not unusual that they lost the House. It's going to be profound in terms of the effect. It's going to lead to Trump's legislative agenda being really dead on arrival effectively in the House. It's going to lead to relentless day-to-day, hour-to-hour, overwhelming investigations with subpoena power conducted by House Democrats. And it could lead to impeachment, which doesn't mean he'll be removed from office, but it will mean he will likely be impeached in the House over the next 6 to 9 months by Democrats. It would then go to the Senate. It's a two-thirds vote in the Senate. It would be very hard to see that many senators voting to remove him from office. But that's what the ramifications of him losing the House, of the Republicans losing the House, will be. Now, that said, as we sit here, it appears Republicans went from 51 to 54 senators. They gained seats in the Senate. How they do that? They did that because the Senate map in 2018 was the single most advantageous map for either party in the last 100 years. You had 25 Democrats up for re-election, only 8 Republicans. 10 of those 25 were up from states that Trump won 2 years ago. And so Republicans were able to flip 4 seats. They flipped Indiana, they flipped Missouri, it looks like they flipped Florida. And then they lost Nevada. They held, looks like they're going to hold Arizona, but lose Nevada. And then they won, I forget if I said North Dakota. North Dakota, Missouri, Indiana, Florida, the 4, excuse me. So in some ways, if you step back for a second, but both sides should be concerned. Democrats lost some races they really thought they were going to win. They thought they were going to win Florida Senate and Florida governor. They thought they were going to win Georgia governor, elect the first African-American governor in the history of Georgia. They thought Beto O'Rourke, this sort of sensation in Texas, was going to shock the world and defeat Ted Cruz. He didn't. He lost by 2.9%, which is the closest a Democrat has come to winning statewide office in Texas since 1994. It's a long time. And they also they lost a number of House seats they thought they were going to win. In some ways, what ended up happening, Joe, is the Democrats benefited because they were able to take back suburban congressional seats where you have college-educated white women generally are a disproportionately large share of the vote. They are repelling Trump. They really don't like his approach. They don't like his the way he communicates, some of the things he does. So they punished Republican members of Congress in those seats. That provided the pathway for Democrats to take the majority back. Conversely, rural America turned out for Trump in these red states where these Senate races were. And so the net effect of keeping the Senate means Trump will be able to get new cabinet secretaries confirmed. We just saw the attorney general position open. You're going to have several others open in the next few weeks. And perhaps most importantly, his judicial confirmations will continue. If Democrats took the Senate back, they weren't going to be able to confirm probably a Supreme Court justice or just judges at the lower levels. He confirmed more judges in his first 2 years than any president in history, 84 judges. That's going to have sweeping ramifications for the judiciary over generations. It'll long outlive his presidency. So there are some warning signs. Republicans cannot lose the suburbs and keep the White House in 2020. Democrats had some sort of rising star progressive candidates who came up short. Both sides, I think, have things that they should be concerned about heading into 2020. Both sides got a little bit of what they wanted. The Democrats really wanted to try to take the Senate back. They were able to get the House back, and that's meaningful. But we're going to have a stalemate in Washington over the next 2 years, and it's going to be ugly combat between both parties over the next 2 years.
You talked about Texas and the Beto O'Rourke-Ted Cruz contest. This was an election that attracted a lot of attention in the UK because of the star power that Beto attracted. He came close to winning, but he didn't win. Similarly, in Georgia, the Democrats came close to winning, but didn't win. What are the implications for Texas and Georgia turning into these purple states that potentially could be won by Democrats come an election in 2020? Is that something Donald Trump should be worried about?
It's a great question. And I think if you step back and you look at 2016, Donald Trump was elected president of the United States for one reason. He was able to crack the code in the Rust Belt in the middle of America, particularly with blue-collar white voters, and develop a path to victory, a path of 207 electoral votes that most people didn't see. Winning Michigan, winning Wisconsin, winning Pennsylvania, having a massive margin in Iowa. So if he can keep, you know, that path together, he'll have a path to re-election. What I think Democrats want to do is they want to change the map. And Texas and Georgia both, either or clearly both, but definitely either of those would change the map. It would make it very difficult for a Republican to be re-elected in 2020 if they were able to flip either one of those states. The reason Texas and Georgia are becoming more competitive is because they're changing demographically in ways that are benefiting Democrats. Minority voters are growing as a share of the vote. In Texas, Hispanics are the plurality. They're on the way to becoming the majority in the next 15 years. And so I think if you look at both sides, I mean, they were able to overperform. You had progressive candidates at the top of the ticket in Texas and Georgia overperform. Beto O'Rourke should not be losing the Senate race in Texas by 2.9%. Texas is a state Republican should win by 8, 10, 12 points. Trump won it by 8.5% November 2016. It should be probably in that 10 to 12 point range realistically. So it's moving in the direction of the Democrats. Can they get to a point where they can really flip Texas or Georgia? I don't know that it's possible in 2020. I think what's more possible is to take those Rust Belt states away from Trump, depending on who they nominate. Could they flip Michigan? Could they take Wisconsin back? Could they take Ohio? Could they take Pennsylvania? Depends on who they nominate, what kind of campaign they run. But sure, I mean, look, if Democrats were ever able to flip Texas, the Republican Party would be a minority party forever. And that's why they go after it every 2 years. They sell the dream of Texas. No, we can win it. We're going to do something differently. Here's why we can do it. And they fall short every 2 years. Now, they fell short in a much more narrow way this time than they have in the last 24 years. And so they probably feel like they're closer than they've ever been. The question will be, can they nominate someone who could win Texas? And is even trying to win Texas worth the investment, the massive, massive investment? No person who's ever run for United States Senate has raised more money than Beto O'Rourke did in either party. And the amazing thing about that is he's not an incumbent. He's a challenger. And he was running in a state that shouldn't have been competitive. And he raised $80 million in 2 years. It's an extraordinary amount of money. Do I think that the Democrats are going to put a fraction of that into Texas to try to flip it in 2020? I don't. I think they have other paths to get to 270 electoral votes, depending on who they nominate.
And finally, Matt, if you had to say, what percentage of Americans do you think believe in possession by the devil?
I had never thought of that. I would say 3%.
3%?
Well, I hope it's very low.
We'll see if you're right at the end of the show.
Good.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Cheers.
Early light.
And for this special edition of Polling Politics from Washington, we are joined from California by the CEO of Smarkets, Jason Trost. Hello, Jason.
Thanks very much for having me. Hello.
Thank you very much for coming on board on this special edition. I want to start by discussing the betting market's overall result from the midterm. So was this a good midterm elections from your point of view?
You know, a lot of times betting markets are called prediction markets. I think it's dangerous to try to think of betting markets being the if something has an 80% chance and doesn't happen, I wouldn't call that the markets get it wrong. Just like if you have the weather forecast say it's going to rain tomorrow and it doesn't rain, you don't say, oh, the weather forecast is no good, I'm never going to use it again. So I think the betting markets are really interesting because it's a real-time aggregation of information, but I think it's kind of the wrong perspective to say, did they get it right or not? That said, I think it was a fairly predictable election. I mean, things went pretty much to plan. The popular wisdom was that the Senate was going to stay with the Republicans and the Democrats were going to take back the House, which indeed did happen. So I think in general, the volatility was in line with what the expectations were for the markets.
And as you said, this was in line with expectations. But were there any specific markets that you were running where the odds were very much upset, where punters could have made some money or lost a lot?
The house market, I don't know what happened. I was in my car and at the stoplight, I checked the market. But, you know, going, you know, pretty much the last few months, the chance of Democrats taking the House was 60-70%, climbed up to about 80%. And then something happened. I think early exit polls came out or something and it dived to like 38%. And then ended up recovering over the next 2 hours or something. But, you know, I think everybody must have thought that it's like, you know, Brexit 2.0 or 2016 2.0. So that was probably the craziest thing that I saw this cycle.
And obviously, from a British perspective, the thing that we are most interested in, and I imagine punters in Britain are most interested in, is the question of what this means for 2020. And this is what we'll be, this is what we've been asking guests this morning. So from the market's point of view, what's happening?
I didn't check this morning, but I think Trump's at about a 30, if I remember correctly, he's about a 38% chance to get reelected, which sounds about right. You know, I think, you know, this stuff is so hard to predict because of what's going to happen with the investigations, the Mueller, you know, the Mueller inquiry. But I would say, you know, about 40% chance is about right for Trump getting reelected in 2020.
And then, of course, the one of the big questions is who the Democrats put up as their contender for president. Beto O'Rourke has attracted a lot of attention in the UK for his campaign, but he didn't win. What is the market for the Democrat contender looking like?
I have to double check that, actually. I know that there's a lot of buzz for Beto. I think he's the second favorite right now at 13%. And the favorite is Kamala Harris, which is the California senator. She's at 18%. These are very thinly traded markets. I wouldn't put too much stock into this. You know, it's really early doors, but it's a fun thing to talk about. You know, being a passionate political follower, there's probably realistically 20 people that are thinking about running for president. So it's a crazy group of people to try to narrow down, and so much can happen between now and tomorrow.
Yeah, of course. And so in terms of timing, when will things really start to pick up from a betting point of view for 2020?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we certainly were trading them, you know, prior to the midterm election. You know, as the event gets closer, the volume kind of spikes. So, you know, if there's 100,000 traded now, there'll be a million traded by the time it gets to the actual election. So I would say about a year out is when things start getting really serious for that market.
And what's your expectation for where the political landscape in America will go over the next couple of years?
I was actually talking about this with my friend last night. You know, for the first time, you know, both him and I are quite worried, actually. There's an angst amongst people that, you know, believe in democracy and believe in political norms and believe in civil discourse that, you know, the direction that the Trump and the GOP is really taking this country is a very dark place. Trump, you know, threw out a journalist from the press corps, which is unheard of. The language that he uses is the language of dictators. He's openly racist. He's openly xenophobic. So I'm very nervous for my country, and I hope that we start getting our stuff together and making improvements. I think this last midterm election was a good first step to try to fix what's been going on, to get some oversight in this White House and try to get things back to normal. But I'm very nervous about it.
And on that happy note, Jason, thank you very much. And thank you to Smarkets for supporting the podcast.
Of course, we're really happy to partner with you guys.
We're joined now by Sarah Binion. Now, Sarah is Director of Monitoring and Evaluations at Defy Ventures. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Joe.
Tell us about Defy Ventures.
Yeah, so we're a national nonprofit that works in and out of prisons, helping men and women with criminal histories and incarceration in their past and present, and felony convictions in their future. And we work to transition them back into the community with personal development and employment readiness and entrepreneurial endeavors.
And there were some votes that were important for prisoners in this election, and we'll come on to that in a second. But just before we do, I wanted to get your take on the overall picture of the elections. Who do you think came out well? Who do you think came out badly?
You know, it's really interesting. It was an interesting election because both sides seem to be claiming victory. The House turned blue, which is an interesting transition, but not unusual in a presidency or administration where everything was red. And when I say blue and red, I know this is for a British audience. So blue are Democrats, red are Republicans.
Much like driving, you get things the wrong way around.
Yes. Precisely. So that means there's now a divided Congress, which makes things more interesting. Things are more difficult to pass in some ways, but to me, it always means that you have to work together and have a better connection to your constituency and to the legislation, and you have to work together and meet in the middle. So it'll be interesting for this administration.
Do you think working together is a possibility, given how divided not just politics are, but also the electorate? Looking at the data, what struck me the most was this increasing move towards the difference between urban voters and rural voters, and the flyover states, as they're sometimes described, and then the coastal elites similarly. And so in such a divided country, is some sort of collaboration going to be possible, do you think?
I mean, look, if legislation wants to get passed, they're going to have to learn to collaborate. Like, it's not really an option. So is it possible? Sure. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, I recently was watching the Ken Burns documentary on Vietnam, and I was watching and looking at how divided the country was during that time period for a decade, through crossing three administrations, and maybe even four. And we were polarized, and, you know, we were having shootouts at, you know, Kent State, et cetera, and the country was disastrous. But yet we managed to, you know, overcome that, heal from that, work through that, and legislation did get passed even within a divided country. So collaboration is possible. I think really, though, at the highest levels, particularly the president, is going to have to learn to be more collaborative because he doesn't have a blank check at this point anymore with a fully read Congress to write things through. So,
taking everything into account, do you think these elections are good news or bad news for Donald Trump? Do they strengthen him or do they weaken him? Or perhaps both?
I think for Donald Trump, he's really going to be challenged to not have the blank check of a fully read Congress. I think that was a nice benefit and bonus to come into. Obama had it too. Obama had it in the first 2 years of his administration, and then Congress shifted red. So it's a lovely thing to have. I think that he is now going to have to be more collaborative if he wants initiatives passed. I think that he will probably focus on things that he's good at, like trade and financial, and by good at I mean things that he can move quickly through the legislative process.
Yeah, good at other than sort of reality TV shows,
right?
And shouting at people.
Right.
And the resignation, if you want to call it that, of Jeff Sessions. Do you think that is a sign of Donald Trump's strength or weakness?
Well, I think most people in the party have left or resigned on some level. I would say that it's not necessarily an indication of strength or weakness, but I would say administratively, he's not doing well at keeping the people that he, you know, tried to come into the office with, and he's lost almost all of his advocates. And Jeff Sessions originally was a huge advocate of his. So, and he is either fired or they have quit. That in and of itself will weaken an administration just by the sheer turnover and attrition.
You mentioned the fact that you work in the area of prison reform. There was a big vote in Florida around voters' rights for prisoners. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting subject that came up quite a bit in the decade of between 96 and 2008 and has slowly changed the landscape of advocacy and rights for men and women with felony convictions. So, explaining to a British audience, the way that America is set up, for the most part, each state has its own laws that allow whatever latitude they want to have with regard to voting rights for men and women with felony convictions. So each state says, either blanket, you can vote from prison, that's at one end, and at the other end is the moment you are convicted of a felony, you lose all your voting rights 100%. Most states are in between. Florida was one of those who was much further on the moment you get a felony conviction, you lose all rights. They did have a process of a grievance process where you could advocate back on behalf of that to get your rights back, but you did have to go before a panel. So the voters in Florida voted to reestablish voting rights for men and women with felony convictions, barring, I believe they have a grievance process in place, but I'm not certain about that, but barring the men and women with murder and sexual assault charges. So they have allowed for the lower level felony offenses, but those higher level capital and murder and sexual crimes, those were not blanket restored.
And this could be important because Florida is such an important swing state come presidential elections, and sometimes the margins of victory are so narrow. Is that right?
That's totally correct. I mean, if you think back to like 2000, right, that was, you know, hanging chads and an election
fun days of 2000. And people were saying, the worst thing that could happen is George W. Bush becoming president. Imagine.
Back in the day. You know, a lot of people really do miss those nostalgic days of George Bush.
Yeah, I think those people are described as Americans. And just finally, Sarah, I'm asking all our guests this morning, what percentage of the American people do you think believe in possession by the devil? This is, of course, completely unconnected to anything we were discussing with Donald Trump. But what percentage do you think?
Dear God, I wish I had a witty response to that. You always hope that your country is less, or is more informed, I should say. But, you know, probably, let's go with 45%.
Well, at the end of the show, we'll see if you're right, and you might win a prize. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
We're joined now by Edie Lush, who is a journalist and co-host of the Global Goals Cast podcast. Hello, Edie.
How are you?
Yeah, we're doing well here in Washington for our special. Edie, what for you were the most interesting stories to come out of the midterms?
I was looking really particularly at one election in Southern California. It's in a district called Fullerton, which is a really interesting part of Orange County. So historically,
so near Los Angeles.
Yes, near Los Angeles, near Disneyland, historically the land of white Republican voters. However, as you know, I'm sure you found out, the demographics in the United States are changing so rapidly, and Fullerton is one of those places in California that has changed enormously over the last few years. You've seen a lot of a movement of Hispanic population into Fullerton, but you've also seen a lot of Asian Americans move in, and very disparate kinds of Asian Americans. So you can't put them all into this one bubble. So you have a lot of Korean Americans, and then you also have a population, for example, of Vietnamese refugees, and now their children. And there was a fascinating story that I followed during the primary season leading up to this election, of whom the Democrats were going to choose to run in this election. And it came down at one point to a choice between Gil Cisneros, who was eventually chosen to run for the Democrats, and a woman who was a doctor. Her name was Minh Tran. She was the daughter of a Vietnamese refugee. She was the story of the American dream. You know, parents came as refugees, did all they could to make sure their daughter had an amazing education. She becomes a doctor, gives back, etc. And the Democrats tell her to stand down against Gil Cisneros. They've chosen their man for the election, and they know who can win against the Republicans.
They've literally chosen their
man.
Yeah,
exactly. And he's, of course, really interesting. He's Hispanic. He's a Navy, you know, ex-Navy. Really interesting and a guy in his own right. But I think they got the demographics wrong, because look who the Republicans chose to run in that election. They chose a Korean-American woman.
Wow, and the Republicans chose that.
And guess who won? By literally about 2% of the vote.
Wow.
The Republicans. So I think it's a lesson for the Democrats of really rethink what's going on in America today, because I think it reflects what's going on in the rest of the world. When you see, I'm sure that when you've spoken to young people who are voting, they care about different things. They care about really different things. Of course, they care about healthcare. Of course, they care about their livelihood and their job outlook. But actually, I think they care about other things. They want to see people who reflect the world that they see around them. They want to see people who look like them who are being elected to office. And we know, as I mentioned in Fullerton, that this is an area of really changing demographics. And you get a voter who wants to see somebody who looks like them coming in, this sort of new face.
And these big questions, as you say, are true across the world, particularly for progressive parties, for finding out what is it they stand for,
yeah.
What is it that they are about, because it's not just about representing the working class or the blue collar workers in the same way that it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Exactly. So I interviewed for my podcast, Global Goals Cast, little plug for it there.
Yeah, plug away. We're all friends here.
Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I interviewed a woman called Tabata Amaral de Pontes, and she is Brazilian, young Brazilian woman, incredible story, came from a favela, educated at Harvard, started with a group of friends a political movement in Brazil, and started a movement because it was in Brazil very difficult to actually start a political party. So they started a political movement aligned with things they cared about, values they cared about, things that they wanted to see reflected in the political system. And along the way made alliances with a number of different political parties. What was interesting about her was that some things that I saw when I interviewed young people who are getting involved in politics in Sri Lanka, in East Africa, in Sierra Leone, in the West, in the United Kingdom, people looking specifically at situations they find appalling. So in Brazil, for example, there was an issue in a school, very local issue in a school, a transgender kid being kicked out of school. One of the issues that this group that Tabata formed came around, got a group of people together to lobby and help educate the school on how to include this kid. Got the kid included, brought the community along, and therefore brought more people to her party. That's a tiny example of some of the other things they did. One of the things that I saw really strongly around the world, as well as political movements in the US and in this election in the US, is the changing role of young women and their voices and how they want to be heard. So I interviewed a woman in Nepal whose big issue is menstrual health. Now, for me, when I started talking to her, I thought, I don't think I've ever spoken about my period in public, ever. And it was
never asked to speak on panels about this.
No. No.
Keynote speeches.
And what's incredible is that my reaction to it was like, oh my God, that's so surprising. And then I thought, this is great. Like, this is exactly what we need. It's a tiny example of when you get more young women involved in politics, they not only bring the issues to the table that they fiercely care about, and by the way, in Nepal, the reason she cares about it so much is because, as you might know, there's this whole thing of terrible tradition of when women have their period, they get put into a cow hut, a cow shed, and left to bleed until they've finished. They're not allowed to touch food, they're not allowed to touch people.
I was not aware of that, but I feel positively unwell at the thought of that. So thank you for that, Evie. So.
But the issue is that she wanted to incorporate change. So again, she gets a group of friends together, starts an NGO in this case, and then lobbies for political change. I think we saw that in the US as well, in terms of how you get young women involved in very specific issues that they care about. Take religious identity. In Obama's presidential election, for example, we saw white religious women not voting for Obama. In this midterm election, there's a very interesting trend that evangelical women not voting for Trump. They're starting to vote, again, not as a group, but for values, for things that they care about.
The obvious question then is, can this movement that you're talking about bring an end to the Trump presidency in 2020?
That is like the trillion-dollar question that I would absolutely love to have an answer for. I truly believe the Democrats need to do some hard work to figure out who it is that they can get that's a really strong candidate.
Because it's no good Donald Trump being unpopular if the person the Democrats choose is similarly unpopular.
And I don't want to go over old, tired ground on why Hillary Clinton didn't win, but it needs to be somebody who's very different from her. So I noticed that John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado, the other day was joking about whether or not he was going to run. Really strong candidate from Colorado, white man, you know, there's a lot to say there.
Do you think it needs to be a man?
I don't think it needs to be a man. I don't think it needs to be a man. I do think that we need to find somebody who doesn't have, I just don't want to get into all of it, but the baggage that the Clintons bring whenever you mention them. I think it needs to be not a dynasty.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Edie, very much. Just one final question. If you had to say, what proportion of Americans do you think believe in possession by the devil?
In possession by the devil?
Yes.
Like that it's an actual thing?
That it's a thing.
Or that it's happening to them?
No, that it's a thing.
10%?
10%. Well, we'll find out at the end of the show. Edie, thank you very much. That's it for this week. A big thank you to all my guests, Edie, Sarah, Matt, and Jason in LA. A big thank you to Smarkets for sponsoring this. And for those of you that were wondering, the number of Americans that believe in possession by the devil is 51%. That's right, a majority of Americans believe in possession by the devil. So that's obviously an absolute delight. We will be back in London for next week. Thank you very much for listening. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.